You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The Supreme Court today, you know, I keep telling you, we have a constitutional monarchy here in the United States. We no longer have a representative democracy or a democratic republic. We have a constitutional monarchy. There are nine people who sit in a building about three blocks from where I am sitting right now, who decide ultimately what the laws of this land are or are not, and in many cases actually even make up laws out of whole cloth. Great example of that being Roe v. Wade, the doctrine of fetal viability, for example. Now, I'm, again, neither speaking for or against that, simply pointing it out. Another one, 2010, well, actually this was a long time, much longer time in the making than Roe v. Wade was. Citizens United, saying corporations are people and money is speech. I mean, these are things that literally came out of the imagination of the Supreme Court. And it, frankly, in my opinion, they have no right to imagine. It is not in the Constitution. But that's a whole nother rant. Today, the Supreme Court got together and heard arguments. Today, it was in Prop 8 in California, which the Mormon Church and Mitt Romney's buddies spent a fortune to get passed to ban gay marriage in that state. And after the state had adopted gay marriage, as I recall, or at least some communities had, San Francisco had. And tomorrow they're going to hear arguments on the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA. And Shane O'Farnon, the associate producer of our program, is also the Supreme Court reporter for the Talk Radio News Service, as well as an attorney, a law school graduate, a guy who knows this stuff far better than I do. Hey, Shano.
I know it somewhat. And what you were speaking about right there, Justice Scalia actually articulated that today about the Supreme Court deciding what the law is. I have it right here.
Really?
Check this out.
We decide what the law is. I'm curious, when?
We decide what the law is.
Yeah.
Actually, it starts a little bit before that. I'm trying to find the clip.
Prescribe law for the future. We decide what the law is.
There it is.
Right.
We decide.
So, as I said, you know, ever since 1803, Marbury versus Madison, really, they didn't start asserting this right and using it until after Dred Scott in 1856. But, you know, the Supreme Court has been saying that they're the kings. Mm-hmm. So in any case, back to Prop 8. What were the arguments today, Shano?
Well, the arguments today were twofold. First, you know, we have the merits of the case, mm-hmm. which everyone knows those arguments. What was really interesting is that there was a standing issue here that hasn't got as much
now,
coverage.
Now, explain what standing is.
Standing is, can you bring the case? Are you the proper person to bring it?
Right.
And under Article 3 of the Constitution, there has to be a case in controversy. So in order to say, court, I want you to hear my case, you actually have to be injured.
Right. In other words, I can't go into court and say, my friend down the street got hit by a car, and so I'm going to sue for $1 million on behalf of him, and just keep the money if I get it. The court would say, no, he can sue, mm-hmm. but you can't.
Even further, you can't just go in and say, I don't like this law. I really hate this law. It's called a general grievance.
Right. You got to say, I don't like this law because
it affects me.
It's causing my left leg to fall off.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, the original case was filed by two gay couples that wanted to get married.
Right.
They won. So then the question
And they
was,
clearly had standing, by the way, because they
right,
were affected.
Because they were affected. But then as they won, then you want to go to the appeal. So who appeals it? The original case was brought by those couples against the governor of the state of California.
Who was Schwarzenegger, who was opposed to gay marriage, so he fought it.
But then it was Brown. And
Jerry Brown is not opposed to gay marriage, and so he says,
I'm not going to.
Yeah.
So there was no one to appeal it. It would normally be the governor or the attorney general. Neither. They both declined to defend Proposition 8 on its merits. So the judge allowed the people who put up Prop 8, the Mormon Church and those types of groups.
A collection of right-wing fringe groups, whatever.
To appeal. And the thing is that they had to also prove that they had standing because they were bringing the appeal.
Right.
The Ninth Circuit said, yes, you do.
Under what rationale?
There's a California case law that people who bring initiatives have standing to defend those initiatives. It's through a court doctrine, essentially. But the thing is that's a California law. And the issue before the Supreme Court is, can California law dictate to us, federal, we the federal courts, what our jurisdiction is?
Okay.
And a lot of the
So these guys arguably had standing in California because it was their proposition got knocked down, but the federal there's no federal law that says
there's no federal court jurisdiction. So they didn't even have standing to go before the Ninth Circuit
as well.
Because that's a federal court and federal courts determine their own jurisdiction. They can go to state court all day.
But the Ninth Circuit still knocked it down, didn't it?
The Ninth Circuit
knocked down Prop 8.
Knocked it down on narrower grounds. But arguably they didn't really even have standing to do that.
So, according to this argument that was placed before the Supreme Court today.
That a lot of the justices seem to agree with. Certainly they had concerns. At one point, Justice Kennedy said, this is a serious jurisdictional issue.
Right.
That it has a lot of credence to it. Because Justice Sotomayor said, people, you may have an interest in defending this, but you're representing the state of California, and you don't have fiduciary duties to the state of California. You're representing your own interests, not the interests of the citizens of the state.
Right. Like so what are you doing in front of us?
What are you doing here? Because those are your interests. Right. Breyer said there's a difference between defending this law and defending the law, which I thought was pretty profound.
Yeah.
So it's quite possible this case could be – they could simply say if they don't want to wade into this and determine rights at this point.
And get involved in states, basically get involved in the 10th Amendment issue.
Exactly.
Then all they have to do is say, this isn't ours. It goes back to the Ninth Circuit, which has already said Prop 8 is unconstitutional in California. And so Prop 8 dies.
It actually would go further, probably, because they would say to the Ninth Circuit, you didn't have jurisdiction to make your ruling.
Okay, so then it goes to the state Supreme Court.
Goes to the federal district court in the state of California. It's a federal district court, the lowest federal court in California.
But that's still a federal court.
They decided that it was unconstitutional on due process and equal protection under the 14th Amendment, and that would stand.
But are you sure that, because that's a federal court, I mean, shouldn't it go to a state court?
No, because the federal court did have jurisdiction, as we said, the same-sex couples who wanted to get married, they had standing to bring their original case. It was the appeal to where there wasn't any standing. The Supreme Court said you must have standing.
So this is when Schwarzenegger was fighting the game.
When it comes to
standing, Prop A gets knocked down.
Right, yeah, exactly. And standing doesn't actually deal with the defendants. It's whether the person bringing the group bringing the actual case.
Right. Now, all that said, I mean, I understand that there's also a way that the court could deny standing, and in doing so could basically say, and by the way, Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid are all unconstitutional. Are you familiar with that argument?
I've read a little bit about this.
Did you hear anything this morning that indicated to you that anybody might be going down that road?
No.
I figured that was more of the kind of...
That was alarmist, tenthers, hopeful, wishful thinking.
Now, you also, when we were talking off the air, you said that Justice Kennedy said something particularly interesting. This is a swing vote. He's a Republican nominee and typically votes with the other four right-wing crazies.
Right.
But he's not a right-wing crazy fully.
He likes being the most popular justice, that's for sure.
Okay.
But there was a line of questions. They were at first talking about what the harm to marriage is if you allow same-sex couples to marry.
Right.
Justice Kagan then turned it around and said, well, what's the harm if you do? Who's going to be harmed? And Justice Scalia piped in saying, well, it's going to hurt adopted kids. But then Justice Kennedy, and essentially what it came down to is they couldn't figure out, and this was Mr. Cooper, who was a proponent of Prop 8, saying any of these damages, any of these things, we don't really know yet because this is really new and, 10, 20, 30 years in the future, there could be all these devastating results, but we really don't know. And Justice Kennedy came in and said, but there is a damage to not allowing this to happen.
Here's the clip.
On the other hand, there is an immediate legal injury or legal, what could be a legal injury, and that's the voice of these children. There are some 40,000 children in California, according to the red brief, that live with same-sex parents. And they want their parents to have full recognition and full status.
So we'll be back right after this with more with Shane O'Farnham and the Supreme Court.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So will the Supreme Court uphold the right of gays to be married in the state of California? And tomorrow, Goma, it's going to be very interesting. Stick with me. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We were just talking with Shane O'Farnan, our associate producer and the Supreme Court reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. law school graduate who had been there this morning at the hearings. We will get back to our conversation with Shano in just a few minutes. But right now, Peter Sprigg is on the line with us. He's a senior fellow with policy studies at the Family Research Council and the author of the Family Research Council's brochure, The Top 10 Harms of Same-Sex Marriage, Family Research Council, FRC.org. And Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Here's just a general question that baffles me. Why would anybody who is straight sit around all day long thinking about gay men and what they're doing and what they should be or should not be doing, or gay women for that matter? Why give it any concern at all? Why all the fear and loathing?
Well, it's not fear and loathing, but there's concern about the institution of marriage because it plays a very important role in our society. Marriage has always existed as a union of a man and a woman.
That's not true.
It's always existed as a male-female union.
No, that's not true.
Until our generation, every religion, every civilization has always...
That is not true.
It is true.
That is not true.
It is absolutely true.
How many wives did Solomon have?
I said a male-female union. Yes, there have certainly been cultures that practice polygamy, but it was always a male-female union.
Okay, so and in the Bible, does it not say that if a man rapes a woman, that's a way that she can become his wife? Yes, it does.
No, that's not exactly what it says.
It is exactly what it says.
All right, are you going to let me answer your question?
My point is that our definition of marriage, and in fact, right up until the 1960s in the United States, it couldn't be a woman and a man who are of different races. You're right. Same-sex marriage is not acknowledged in the Bible, but the quote definition of marriage that you're promoting is very different from the definition of marriage through the vast majority of biblical history.
Well, let's get aside from biblical history. Let's just talk about biology. It takes a man and a woman to make a baby, and it takes a man and a woman to give a child both a mother and a father. That's the reason why we define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Those are important public purposes. Reproduction is an important purpose for society, and we know that children do best when raised by their own biological mother and father, committed to one another in a lifelong marriage. And our definition of marriage...
So sterile people should not be allowed to marry.
There's no way to eliminate, to exclude them from marriage without very intrusive inquiries that we probably would not tolerate.
Which are very similar to the very intrusive inquiries that you want to make of gays.
No, we know absolutely that no same-sex couple will ever reproduce by natural...
Well, I'll raise my hand right now. I had a vasectomy after our third child was born. I am not capable of producing children. Are you telling me that I should now divorce my wife?
Well, I don't know what your wife's condition is, and I've heard of people who have still conceived children after
she
having...
She probably could conceive. I don't know.
100%. The point is that there is a difference between men and between opposite sex unions as a class and same sex unions as a class. It's an immutable and undeniable difference, and that's why we treat them differently.
Well, wait a minute. Are you suggesting that in vitro fertilization doesn't exist?
There are other... Not every child is born as a result of a married husband and wife, but it is the norm, and I think it's legitimate for the law to uphold that as a norm and an ideal.
Well, it's the majority. It's not necessarily the norm, but it's the majority is normal biological sexual intercourse produces babies, but there is a statistically significant number of people who go through in vitro fertilization. It's a growing number, and it's also something that particularly lesbian couples are using. And that satisfies your requirement that they be able to have children.
It doesn't satisfy the requirement that they provide those children with both a mother and a father, though, which is also an important element of it.
Well, but we have, the preliminary evidence on the studies of kids who've grown up in gay families is that they're turning out just fine. Thank you very much.
Well, that's not what the study done by...
That's what the American Academy of Pediatrics said last week.
Yeah, the American Academy of Pediatrics is relying upon studies that have been shown to be very methodologically weak. And
wait a minute,
at best, there
Peter,
is not...
you're going up against the doctors, the pediatricians, the doctors who treat children. You're telling them they don't know what they're talking about?
because it's not, there was not a poll taken of every member of the American Academy of Pediatrics before this was done. That policy statement represented the position of the six people who wrote it. And there's another American College of Pediatricians which has taken exactly the opposite position. So pediatricians are not united on
the that. American College of Pediatricians is not the official AMA recognized agency. It's a right wing spinoff, or you know, a right wing crank group. The American Academy of Pediatrics, the official group that represents pediatricians in the United States, has said kids do just fine in gay families.
Well, they're taking a position that, frankly, that's based on political correctness and not based on the science. And the same is true of the AMA, the APA, and a lot of these professional organizations. For decades now, ever since the early 1970s, they've been controlled by political correctness and not by the science. It's really shameful.
So do you think it was really shameful when in the 1960s we started letting people of different races marry?
No, because racial segregation never had anything to do with the purpose of marriage. When there were laws against interracial marriage, those were burdening the institution of marriage in pursuit of a goal that had nothing to do with the purpose of marriage. They were burdening the institution of marriage in pursuit of racial segregation.
But you're arguing that the purpose of marriage is to produce children, and I'm saying, you know, producing children, A, is not always the consequence of marriage. In fact, it's frequently people produce children without marriage. And B, I'd say the real purpose of marriage is to be able to inherit, to be able to visit your spouse in the hospital, to be able to have literally tens of thousands of benefits. I mean, there's over 10,000 laws on the books in the United States that have the word marriage in them, and almost all of them have to do with economics.
Well, in California, whose law was being debated before the Supreme Court today, same-sex couples already have 100% of the rights and benefits of marriage under California state law.
But not under federal law.
Well, that's true. But
Not by the Internal Revenue Service. And so why should we discriminate against them?
Well, again, the public...
Because they can't have babies?
Because the public purpose of marriage is to encourage responsible procreation. That may not be
no. The public purpose of marriage is to.
There'd be no reason without procreation. There would be no reason for it to be a public institution.
That's okay, I will leave you with the last word, Peter Sprigg, FRC.org. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, are you childless?
Out for that marriage now.
We'll be back. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, and Shane O'Farnan also with us. Shane is a law school graduate and is the Supreme Court reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. He was this morning at the Supreme Court. I understand that the seats were selling for $6,000 a pop.
Were they really?
I saw that headline somewhere.
Wow, I wish I knew that.
$6,000.
I wish I'd known that. No. Mine was a press pass. It's not transferable.
Yeah, I think but people have been standing in line for a long, long time.
All weekend. I saw the reports early Saturday morning of people camped outside, and the weather was not too nice around here.
Yeah, so we were talking with Peter Sprigg, and I'm still baffled by this, you know, these men at the Family Research Council who are sitting around all day long thinking about gay men.
And worrying about it, yes.
Yeah, and worrying about this. Or about the institution of marriage. I mean, I've been married 40 years, and I just don't much care about, don't worry about the institution of marriage, because
Sure. It's like, I heard a great argument that someone put forward. He said, it's not like we're going to run out of marriage licenses. The gays aren't going to take all the marriage rights licenses. You know, it's one of those rights that isn't a zero-sum game.
Right.
That if someone else gets the right to marriage, you aren't losing yours.
Right, and I think that the only kind of people who would make the argument that, oh my God, if gay marriage is legal, then you may see some straight marriages dissolve, would be people like Larry Craig.
Sure.
I mean, that seriously.
I
gays who are closeted and are in a marriage that is just there for political purposes or whatever. Beyond that. So anyhow, we had Peter Sprigg on, and Peter said basically the purpose of marriage is to produce babies.
Right.
I'm assuming that argument had to have been brought before the Supreme Court.
It was. That was the main argument. Ted Olson answered it great.
Okay. Now, Ted Olson, just for the record, former major Republican operative, Solicitor General under George W. Bush, the guy who argued Bush v. Gore before the Supreme Court and got the Supreme Court to give the presidential election of 2000 to George W. Bush, even though Al Gore won the election.
Yes.
Got a half million more votes,
yes,
and ultimately won more votes in Florida. So Ted Olson has made his, and is not gay.
No.
In fact, his wife died in the 9/11 attack. She was on one of the planes. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, she was on the plane that hit the Pentagon, as I recall. So Ted Olson said...
He instead of saying that the state has this right to decide what marriage is, he turned it around. He says that the institution of marriage is not society's right. It's an individual's right that this court, again and again and again, has said the right to get married, the right to have a relationship of marriage, is a personal right. Hmm. And it's part of the right of privacy, the right of association, the right of liberty, and the right of the pursuit of happiness.
Are you reading his words?
I'm kind of paraphrasing, but the transcript
from
is
from his transcript.
Yeah, I couldn't come up with something so profound. But essentially turning it on its head, saying the state's interest is in protecting marriage, but it's an individual right. And by excluding someone, you're denying rights. And society itself is not going to be harmed. Procreation is one of the interests of the state. But people have an individual right to privacy, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
Which includes the right of marriage.
Which includes the right of marriage, which the Supreme Court has recognized.
Now, my principal argument against Peter Schiff was, or Peter Spear, rather, was that, you know, procreation may or may not be part of why we have marriage. And I think there's broad consensus that it has something to do with it.
Sure.
And probably a lot to do with it. But most laws that involve marriage are actually economic laws. Mm-hmm. They have to do with contract law. They have right. to do inheritance. They have to do with taxes. And
but
these
he astutely pointed out that in the state of California, though, all of those civil laws, those contractual laws, are already in place.
Except that if
except
you're,
the word marriage.
Well, no. If you're in California and you have a civil union, you cannot file joint tax returns.
That's a federal law.
That's
though.
My
that's
point.
Tomorrow.
So
that's tomorrow.
Right.
That's DOMA.
But wasn't that brought up today, that if you're in California under Prop 8, you are denied federal benefit? I mean, this is federal court, U.S. Supreme Court.
No, because that's the DOMA case. This is whether or not California can just say, we're not going to call it marriage.
So this was much more narrowly argued than the debate that Peter and I just had.
Yes. And he was correct in saying that California, you pretty much have all the same rights.
Except, if you call it a civil union.
But if you call it a civil union. But that's kind of a separate but equal argument.
Sure.
And what Ted
you
Olson
two
said,
can go to a school. It's just only for your people.
Yeah, it's just as good, but it's over there.
Yeah.
And Ted Olson said over and over that it's a stigmatization that occurs.
Right.
That you are different and you are less if you are a same sex and you only have a civil union, not a marriage. And that's just unequal. And that's
right.
not fair.
That doesn't satisfy the requirements of the 14th Amendment.
Right.
And that was ultimately what the Supreme Court decided in a variety of cases, starting with Brown v. Board with regard to race.
Yes.
And so now we're looking at doing this.
But the reason they want to get to this procreation is to differentiate it from Loving, which was the interracial marriage.
Right. Loving being the Supreme Court case, not the verb.
Yes.
Yes. Loving versus Texas, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and which ruled that it is possible for a people of different races to marry.
It's not even possible that it's unconstitutional to prevent them from.
Right, right. Yeah, thank you. Shano, thank you very much.
No problem.
Anything you wanted to add, or is that that's pretty much your summary? Okay, let's
pick
up some calls here. Susan in Darby, Montana, listening on AM 760 out of Denver. Hey, Susan. You are on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Okay. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm going to make a couple of quick points. First off, my husband has had a vasectomy too, and I was so grateful to hear somebody talk about what the real value of marriage is. I'm 56, he's 64. We cannot reproduce. And marriage is so valuable. It's about a loving, committed relationship.
Mm-hmm.
We are also the grandparents of a wonderful little boy whose father came out of the closet and our daughter and him divorced. And Prop 8 is so dear to our hearts because we want to protect our grandson from all of the terrible things that are said. You know, that his father is bad or evil, which then makes the child feel they're bad or evil.
Yeah.
Our grandson is perfect, and we show him a loving relationship. And as a grandmother, you want to see me get upset? Go ahead. They're really hurting children.
Yeah, yeah. Very well said, Susan. Thank you very much for calling and sharing that story with us. I much appreciate it. Ed in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, listening on Sirius. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'd just like to offer the Christian Tea Party take on this issue. Primarily, one of the things that when I was in the service we talked about and we discovered by analyzing empirical research is that among homosexuals, there is a significant increase in drug use, alcoholism, clinical depression, suicide, homicide, domestic violence.
Ed, that is always, you know, particularly if you're looking at statistics from the 1950s and 1960s, you would find the same thing among statistics about African Americans in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. When you have people who are oppressed, who are marginalized, who are called horrible names, who are bullied when they're children, I mean, the number one risk of suicide in the United States right now is to be teenage and gay. If those are your circumstances, then yes, you are at higher risk of having problems with alcohol, having problems with drugs, having all of those things. But I would submit to you, Ed, that those are not all of those things that you just described don't come about because of a person being gay. They come about because of bigots reacting to their being gay. And what we need to do, if we want to stop that drug abuse and we want to stop that alcoholism and we want to stop that teenage suicide rate, is we need to stop being bigots. Will you join me in doing that, Ed?
I think that the homosexuals are the ones that are being victimized by having people like you disregard these statistics. And let me point out three reasons why.
Ed, did you not hear what I said?
Well, let me give you the facts. In countries where it's more generally accepted, those statistics are the same, or they're equivalent. Number two, you said Americans. There was, look at the statistics. Over in the Benelux countries in Northern Europe, there's comparable demographics. There's the same type of trend or statistics.
Ed, there is no place in the world right now where gays have full equality and full acceptance with everybody else. What I'm saying is that you're going to see with any oppressed minority, whether it's gays, whether it's people whose skin color is different, whatever it may be, with any oppressed minority, you're going to people who have a different religion, you're going to see some people who don't deal with that oppression well, and it breaks them rather than strengthens them. And the cure to that is for us as a society to stop behaving like bigots. People do not choose to be gay. They are born gay. People don't choose to have brown skin or white skin, for that matter. They're born that way. And when people like you come along and say, oh, but we should treat them differently, or we should shun them, or we should forbid them from having the same rights as the rest of us, it makes their situation even worse. You are the one who is causing gay teenagers to commit suicide, Ed. And you got to reconcile that. You got to come to terms with that. And frankly, you should be begging God for forgiveness for that.
John, the majority of homosexuals are dying from maladies associated with the lifestyle.
Ed, you said that you are a Christian. Tell me when Jesus Christ condemned gay people.
You're glossing over the fact that there are...
Please tell me when Jesus condemned gay people. I would encourage you to go back and read Matthew, the story of the Last Supper, when John is resting with his head on Jesus' chest throughout the whole entire dinner. And finally, Peter wants to ask Jesus a question, so he turns to John, the one who Jesus loved, whose head was resting on Jesus' chest, and said, "What do you mean about that?" They were talking about Judas. And so John, you know, relays the question to Jesus, and Jesus responds. And John still has his head on Jesus' chest. Now, I'm not suggesting that John and Jesus were getting it on, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if John was gay and not acting sexual, but just being affectionate, and Jesus was fine with that. What do you think?
Well, it's amusing that you're citing the Bible for an issue that we can study.
I would encourage you to read the story of the Last Supper, Ed. It's right there. It's right there. And as I said, I think it shows Jesus did not say, "John, get off my chest. Get your head away from me. I'm not going to sit here with a guy with his head on my chest through an entire meal. I'm a homophobe. I'm scared. No, Jesus didn't say that. Jesus, you know, just continued to hang out with John. Ed, Get it. Read it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I love debating Christianity with Christians. It's amazing to me how many Christians have never even read the Bible. We'll be back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike. You're concerned about polygamy? Really?
Well, yeah, I'm just saying, as far as marriage as a contract, right, you know, with the Equal Protection Clause,
right,
wouldn't they have to allow any minority group, give them the same rights that they're given to the gays as
If by any minority group you mean more than two people, no, they don't have to. There's no requirement. There's no federal requirement.
Why is that different? I mean, they're basing it on just a, you know, a consensual relationship that's loving and, you know, and they want to be together. I mean,
because we've already had that fight. Up until the mid-1800s in the United States, there were a number of states that recognized polygamous marriages. And Utah was, you know, right up at the top of that list. And although they weren't a state at that time, they were territory. And in order for Utah to join the United States, and of course this is the epicenter of the Latter-day Saints Church, and there were, you know, many, if not most, of the men who were members of the LDS Church had multiple wives. In order for Utah to join the United States, the federal, whatever it is, it was the legislature. It was the House and the Senate, because they would have to ratify the acceptance of a new state. They basically said, you have to outlaw polygamy. We will not allow a polygamous state into the Union. And so Utah outlawed polygamy, and then, you know, that year or the next year, they became a state. We had that battle back in the 1800s, and it's done. Marriage is a contract. It is a legal contract, and it is a legal contract between two people. That has been that fight has already been fought. It's also not a contract between children and adults. That law, you know, that battle has been fought, and it's not a contract between humans and animals. That law has been fought. There are laws against bestiality. There are laws against pedophilia. There are laws against polygamy. There is no. And none of those groups are going to successfully assert any kind of right in court. And this is, and by the way, Mike, I encourage you to go back. You probably can't find a lot of it on the internet, because the internet pretty much doesn't know about anything that happened before the 1980s when the internet came into being. But back in the 1950s and 60s, and I remember this, you know, very clearly, in part because my next door neighbor when I was a kid was a white woman who married a black guy. And this and my dad ended up walking her down the aisle because her father wouldn't. And this was a big deal. And I heard, you know, all this yelling and screaming and gnashing of teeth about this stuff. And the argument was made that if you allow black people to marry white people, pretty soon you're going to have, you know, people wanting to marry their dogs or people wanting to marry their three next-door neighbors. And it was nonsense then. It's nonsense now. These are arguments used to justify bigotry.
But now, are you saying that if, let's say you use Utah, for example, that they had legalized gay marriage back then, do you think that the federal government would have said, unless you get rid of that law, you can't become a state?
I think in the 1880s, it's entirely possible. I think the standards change over time. And, you know, it's not inconceivable that some time in the far distant future will come when, you know, we say, well, maybe polygamy, maybe not. I don't think so, though, because polygamy... You have to look at cultures in context. Look at them as a sociologist. What are the circumstances under which polygamy makes sense? There actually are some. The conditions under which polygamy makes sense, Mike, is when you have a largely disproportionate number of people of one gender. And in a warrior society, in the kind of societies that you had, you know, back when King David and King Solomon were running around loose, and they would read the book of Joshua, read the Bible. It's just filled with battle after battle after battle in which thousands and thousands of men are killed. And so you've got a lot more women than you have men. Under those kind of circumstances, the polygamy that was accepted in the Bible makes a certain amount of sense. But the biggest problem that the Mormon polygamists have right now is the men aren't being killed off, and the men aren't dying off. So what the Mormons are doing in these polygamous communities down in Arizona and in Mexico and in Colorado and in various places is they start picking out the boys in their teenage years that they don't like, and they're old enough to kind of make it on their own. They're 16, 17, 18 years old, but young enough to, you know, basically be subject to the whims of their parents, and they're expelling them from the community. So you've got all these Mormon boys who are being thrown out. Polygamy doesn't make social sense when you have a 1-to-1 ratio of men to women. If you have a 1-to-2 ratio of men to women, polygamy starts to make sense. If you got a 1-to-5 ratio of men to women, polygamy actually makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, there are places in Africa that have experienced continual warfare for years and years. I was in South Sudan, and the woman who was the mayor of Gok Machar, the town that I was staying in, a little town of 7,000 people with 40,000 refugees in it, 15 miles from the Darfur border, 500 miles from the nearest dirt road or electricity. She was something like the 72nd wife of some guy. I mean, he had a whole bunch of wives. But this is a country that had been in such, I mean, they've been in a civil war for years and years, and they've been fighting the British before that, and there were, you know, a lot of women and very few men. So,
but doesn't that argument hold true with the homosexuals, too, that there's plenty of men and plenty of women?
I would say that, no, because what you find is that the percentage of gay men and the percentage of gay women is about the same in our society. So they're self-selecting.
I'm saying in general, men and women. I mean, if a gay man wanted to find a woman, they're out there. I mean, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, but he doesn't want to.
And they have the right to get married, just not to a man.
But he doesn't want to, Mike.
For polygamy holds true then.
No, it doesn't.
He wants to marry more than one woman.
No, I'm not saying that the desires should drive this thing. I'm saying that societies change over time. We accepted multiracial marriage for a reason because, you know, we started out maintaining the institution of slavery in this country because it economically made sense to the founders. Now, I'm not arguing in favor of it. In fact, I think it was heinous. But this country was built on slavery. There's not a major building in Washington, D.C. where I'm sitting right now that wasn't built by slaves, including the White House and Congress. And that was the institution. And people fought against that institution, but as a country, we fought for that institution for a long time. And we have to acknowledge that. It was a horrible mistake. It was a holocaust. And as we walked back from that and we said, you know, that was a horrible thing, we white people, said that was a horrible thing that we did to African Americans. We got to clean this up. You know, we're still in the process, frankly, of doing that. And I would submit to you that we've been doing the same thing to gay people, who, by the way, are born by and large, are born gay. And just like, you know, Mike has dropped off the phone, so I was just going to say it. At some point, I'm guessing, you know, when you were a kid, you knew whether you were straight or gay, Mike. And so did all the rest of us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, I got to tell you about something that's going on in Tennessee that is going to absolutely blow your mind. I also want to talk about North Korea. I don't know if you have seen the movie. Louise and I actually went to see it. Olympus Has Fallen. Louise and I went to see this movie on Sunday. It was like we were so brain dead. I mean, I have been working on this book for 2 years. And finally got the book off to the publisher Sunday night. And you know, I've got email from a month and a half ago that I haven't even responded to from members of my family. I mean, every minute, it's just incredible. In fact, you know, I can go back and look at it. I can tell you, I've got email from February 1st to which I have not yet responded. From, you know, this is like, I need to get a life. So anyway, Friday night or Saturday, Sunday night after we sent the manuscript off, it was like, oh, we just need to go get entertained, get outside, get out of my head and get out of the crash of 2015. And so we went to see this movie, Olympus Has Fallen, and it was just good, dumb fun. North Korea, you know, sends some agents and they blow up the White House and take the president. And I'm not giving away the movie because you can't give away this kind of movie. I mean, it's a Bruce Willis movie without Bruce Willis. It was just good, dumb fun. And the critics hated it, and the viewers loved it. And, you know, what can you say? If you like violence in movies. And frankly, Louise and I both kind of enjoy cartoonish violence. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger's True Lies, also one of our favorite movies. And people say, oh, but that makes little kids shoot up schools. No, actually, in Canada and in Japan and in Europe, they, you know, their kids watch the same violent movies our kids do, and they don't shoot up schools. There's something else going on here. But that's a whole other rant. In any case, it's all about North Korea, and I want to get into that in a minute. But first, I want to tell you about what's going on in Tennessee. Down in Tennessee, speaking of movies, remember the movie The Hunger Games? Where it's like, you're living in poverty out in the middle of nowhere, and you want to have a good life, you want to have health care, you want to have something decent, you have to do the lottery. Well, the Firesign Theater played a variation on this, on kind of what's going on in Tennessee right now. Way back in the 1960s, in their album Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him. Let me set the scene. This poor schlub gets kidnapped and dragged into this game show. He wakes up in this game show and discovers that he's on a game show where they shoot you up with a disease and you have 10 seconds to figure out what you've got and beat the, you know, the Grim Reaper. Beat the Reaper. And, well, here's how it turned out in the Firesign Theater's, by the way, their website, firesigntheater.com. Here's how it turned out in their version with permission of the Firesign Theater.
He's coming around, folks. He's gonna be okay and ready to play Symptom 6 of Beat the Reaper!
Last week, our patient successfully survived the common cold, measles, pneumonia, dengue fever, and the yaws.
And now, the big question. Are you ready to go on?
What? Where?
He's ready!
Our topless nurse, Judy, is wheeling our patient into the isolation ward.
Can you hear me in there? Okay, let's shoot him up. Now, patient, you have 10 seconds to tell us what you've got and beat the Reaper.
I'm shaking with paper. My hands are all turning yellow. My God, I've got jaundice.
He actually identified the disease that time, but here comes
now
another
you've
one.
Reached the final threshold. Here's the question. Are you ready for symptom number 7, longer than any patient has ever survived before?
I want to go home.
Only one way to do that. Doctor, bring in the super shot.
Now, for the first time on Beat the Reaper, we're going for the big disease. The icebox is being unlocked by the president of the Armenian Medical Association, under whose strict supervision these toxins are being administered.
This is it. Doctor, give him that really big disease. Now, patient, can you hear me? You've got 10 seconds to tell us what you've got, and for the last time, beat the Reaper!
I want to die.
I'm terribly sorry. That's not correct. You didn't beat the Reaper. Doctor, bring the patient out and show the amphitheater audience and all the folks at home just what he's contracted.
According to my careful prosthesis, this man has the plague.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome.
You've got the plague. Well, isn't he a good sport, folks?
Well, isn't he a good sport, folks? Yes, you have the plague. It's the lottery, right? It's the game show. Well, a variation on this is going on in Tennessee right now because of Republican Governor Bill Haslam. I think I'm pronouncing that right. H-A-S-L-A-M. He is the Republican governor of Tennessee. 180,000 people in Tennessee are eligible for health care under an expansion of Medicare. These are all people who are blind, elderly, disabled, or the caretaker of a child who qualifies for Medicaid and themselves are low-income people. They have to fall in one of those categories. 180,000 people, and right now they have no health care. They have no health insurance. So they're not going to beat the Reaper. So twice a year, what Tennessee does is they have a lottery. They open the phone lines.
The phone lines are open, folks.
This happened yesterday or the day before. This is the twice a year thing. And the first 2,500 people who get through, they take their calls and they send them an application for this health insurance. And if they qualify, and presumably only people who are calling would qualify, then 2,500 people out of the 180,000 who would be eligible for it, 2,500 people get health insurance under Medicaid. Now, Obamacare, as passed by Congress, would instantly give all 180,000 qualifying people in the state of Tennessee free health insurance. Bing! just that fast. But when it went before the Supreme Court, in their infinite wisdom, one of the things that the justices said was, you cannot force a state to take federal money. Even though for the first 3 years, it's 100% free to the state, the federal government will pay for all of it, all those 180,000 people. And after that, the federal government forever is going to pay 90% of it. You still can't force a state to take money. So the governor of Tennessee has said, you know, I don't want that money, as have the governors of many Republican states. So a couple days ago, they opened the phone lines and 2,500 people called. And I mean, you read the stories of this. It is just absolutely incredible about people who are dialing over and over and over and over and over again. And in fact, they even suggested that people should have, here, this is state residents who have high medical bills but would not normally qualify for Medicaid. The government health care program can call a state phone line and request an application, but the window is tight. The line shuts after 2,500 calls, typically within an hour. And the demand is so high that it's difficult to get through. Russell Overby, a lawyer with the Legal Aid Society in Nashville, said, it's like the Oklahoma land rush for an hour. We encourage people to use multiple phones and to dial and dial and dial. Yes, you too, if you live in Tennessee, can try to beat the Reaper and be one of the 2,500 lucky people out of the 180,000 people who would qualify if your Republican governor would just take that free Medicare money that Obama is offering in Obamacare. But he's a Republican, so he wants you to suffer, so you will blame the federal government. You get it?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So in Tennessee, oh, so sorry, you didn't beat the Reaper. But isn't he a good sport, folks? He's going to reelect a Republican. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So, yes, I so love that Beat the Reaper. Can you play just the first 20 seconds of that, Shano? This is the Firesign Theater, firesigntheater.com.
He's coming around, folks. He's going to be okay and ready to play Symptom 6 of Beat the Reaper.
There we go. Yes, in Tennessee now, you can play Beat the Reaper. Well, you can't do it again for another 6 months. So, you know, and Tennessee, by the way, isn't the only state where you've got a Republican governor saying, no, we're not going to take any Medicare funds that come with Obamacare, because if we took that Medicare money from Obamacare, then we would be providing people with health insurance who don't have it, and we would have to tell them that Barack Obama made this possible. And, oh, my God, if we did that, they might start voting for Democrats. I mean, this is the very simple math. Obamacare was a Republican program proposed originally by Richard Nixon in 1972. And opposed by Teddy Kennedy because it involved private health insurance companies. Teddy Kennedy basically blocked it. Big mistake in retrospect, but, you know, Kennedy worked most of his life trying to atone for that mistake. But it was first proposed by Richard Nixon. And then in the 1980s, it was proposed again by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, or maybe it was in the 90s. And then Mitt Romney, when he was governor of Massachusetts, the Republican governor of Massachusetts, put it into place. And then Barack Obama, as president of the United States, put it into place. And it wasn't until Obama came forward and said, hey, let's do what Romney did in Massachusetts, that all of a sudden the Republicans hated it. This is all about politics. This governor of Tennessee, Bill Haslam, is willing to let people die in his state rather than have them think that there's anything in it for them in Obamacare. They literally have a lottery down in Tennessee. Twice a year for your eligibility for the TEM Care program. Now, to qualify to get into the lottery, you have to be poor. And you have to be blind or otherwise disabled or caring for a child who is poor and disabled or elderly. And you have to have large medical bills. You got to already be in trouble. to qualify for this program. 180,000 people in Tennessee right now qualify. Twice a year, they open the phone lines for about an hour. It takes about an hour for 2,500 people to get through and give their names and addresses and get the, you know, get into the program. Twice a year for an hour or so. You get a chance to beat the Reaper. This is just wrong. I mean, this is so wrong. Okay, I've ranted about that. I want to talk about North Korea. And then, you know, after the break, we'll pick up your phone calls. I see there's still a lot of people who want to talk about gay marriage, which is fine. Or we can move on to other topics. And in fact, there's one other thing I wanted to comment on. And I just want to say this. Last night, I think it was on Rachel Maddow's program. She had a psychologist on, as I recall. I only caught the last half of the segment, so I don't recall the setup. And we don't have one of those machines that records TV shows. So, but my understanding was that they were like, hey, look at this. George W. Bush is painting all these paintings, and mostly of his dog and of him in the shower and the bathtub. And what does this say about George W. Bush? And, you know, why would he paint himself being bathed? And I'm yelling at the TV screen going, because he's trying to wash the blood off. And I kept waiting for somebody to say it, because I think, you know, I mean, if you're going to try and psychoanalyze somebody who is responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of people, the unnecessary deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, then you don't have to have, you know, a PhD in psychology and 30 years in the field to think that there's at least some small possibility that they feel that they have, quote, blood on their hands, end quote. There's a, you know, very popular expression. And so he's painting himself being bathed. And it hasn't occurred to anybody that Bush thinks that he has blood on his hands and he's trying to wash it off, or he's painting himself in a way that shows that it has been washed off. One of the cartoons over on Daily Kos today showed on the left panel, it was George Bush painting his feet in the bathtub. And then in the right panel, it was a vet who had both his legs amputated below the knee, sitting on a TV couch with his stubs of his upper legs showing, you know, with a TV remote control in his hand, watching the news story about George W. Bush painting his own feet in the bathtub, smiling George W. Bush. Oh, isn't that cute? He's an artist. Right. So, and finally, I mentioned North Korea. I'm wondering if Kim Jong-un, who is a major American movie freak and loves action adventures, I'm wondering if he saw Olympus Has Fallen, where the North Koreans nearly, they come within milliseconds of taking out the United States. And I mean really seriously taking out the United States. You'll know what I'm talking about if you see the movie. And I'm not, you know, saying everybody should go out and see the movie. It's not something like Django, you know, that has actually profound, or Les Mis, that, you know, speaks to a historical era and people should know about it, that kind of thing. This is just good, dumb fun. Or maybe even bad, dumb fun. But it's about the North Koreans nearly taking out the United States. Nukes and all. Now I'm wondering if Kim Jong-un saw that movie a couple of months ago when it first started leaking out in bootleg as they were, cutting up the final editions of it. Maybe got his spies to steal him one off the interwebs from the movie production company, and now he's going nuts.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Maybe Dennis Rodman even brought it along, Jim says. Who knows? Too much psychoanalyzing today. Maybe, maybe not. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. It's your media support group for We the People of the United States of America. This situation in North Korea has me concerned. I just, you know, World War I started out with, you know, Archduke Archduke Ferdinand being assassinated in Sarajevo. And because one country had treaties with another country, and I've now forgot the whole chain, but basically it was, you know, your guy gets killed, our guys go to war, and it's just like this all started World War One. And we have these treaties with South Korea. We just signed one. Here's the essence of the thing with Korea that's the big deal that's got North Korea going nuts, is that we said that it's not going to take an invasion of South Korea by North Korea to trigger us coming into the war. All they have to do is drop some bombs on you, throw some shells into South Korean territory, and we will respond. And therefore, the North Korean army now is on full alert. Their navy is on high alert. They're freaked. So never underestimate, you know, a paranoid running a country. Now, you know, case in point, the last administration, it's last Republican administration. Anyhow, Wayne in Newcastle, Oklahoma. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Mr. Hartman, I was just, you know, sitting here listening to you, and I think you're a very intelligent man, and everybody has their views of what this country is great about.
Yeah.
You know, but my big thing is, you know, like the health care thing. And the entitlement situation in this country. I mean, I have been down to the bottom, you know, to where at point in time I didn't know where my last meal was going to come from. But I always picked myself up by my bootstraps and done like my grandparents and my parents taught me and went on. You know, I picked up and I went and made something.
Wayne, most Americans have done the same thing.
You know, a handout.
That's true of the vast majority of Americans. What's your point?
Well, my point is, I mean, it's like the healthcare system. I mean, I got a notice about a month ago from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oklahoma and Texas. And my healthcare, due to Obamacare, is going to go up over $2,000 a month as of next year.
Yeah, it's not Obamacare that's causing that to go up. What's causing your healthcare to go up? And I mean, just go back and look at it. During the Reagan administration, prior to the Reagan administration, if you wanted to run a hospital, it had to be not-for-profit. And if you wanted to run a health insurance company, it had to be not-for-profit. And Reagan encouraged the various states to change those laws. And many of them, in fact, by the end of the 1990s, all of them had changed those laws. And that's when Bill Frist's daddy went on a buy-in binge. He went around buying up county hospitals and ended up with, I think it was called HCA. It's worth like $4 billion. And he would take these old not-for-profit hospitals that were running very well. Healthcare costs were very low. He'd jack up the costs. He'd reduce the quality of service. And he made billions with a B, billions. And then the health insurance companies could go for-profit. So United Healthcare started hustling health insurance really hard. And Dollar Bill McGuire, the guy who was running United Healthcare back in the 80s and the 90s, he made over $1.7 billion. That's how much he took out of your premiums. And if you had health insurance with United Healthcare. And his successor, Stephen J. Hemsley, is running it right now. He's taken over $1 billion. He's got over 100 executives making over $1 million a year. That's what's jacking up the cost of health care. Obamacare has actually reduced the cost of health care in a number of very clearly measurable ways. And Wayne, if you can give me one example. One actual legitimate example, other than some soundbite from Fox News where somebody says it's so, because I'm telling you, these people are lying to you. But give me one example where Obamacare is raising the cost of health care.
Well, I mean,
then you win the prize.
Okay, well, I must not be that intelligent. I mean, but I know what my health care costs me now.
Do you have one example? You're blaming it on Obamacare. I'm telling you, it's rich guys who are running these big companies, and they are getting while the getting is good. In fact, Obamacare says that a health insurance company, you had health insurance companies in the United States who are taking 30, 40, 50% of the premiums and just sticking it in their damn pockets. And Obamacare capped that at 30%, I think it's 30%, it might be 25% for smaller companies, and 25 or 20% for the very largest companies. So you can't rip people off for more than that. But you know what the overhead cost, and that would be a total overhead. That's salaries, private jets, marketing expenses, fancy buildings, gold faucets in the bathrooms, all that stuff. Dividends to stockholders, no more than 20%. So out of every $100 you're spending, $20 or $25 or $30 of it is going into the pocket of some fat cat. You know, with Medicare, Do you know how much, what the percentage is that goes to overhead, that goes to all the people who administer the Medicare program, who write the checks, who check the claims, who make sure that, you know, the money's being used properly? You know what the percentage is?
No, sir. No, sir. I do not.
It is 3%.
3%.
3%. Okay. Out of every $100 Medicare spends, $3 goes to administration. And what this demonstrates, this is why every other country in the world, Wayne, spends half as much money on health care as we do, and we're number 27 in terms of outcomes. There's 26 countries that have better health care outcomes than we do, and all of them spend roughly half or less than half of what we do. And it's because they don't have rich guys like Bill Frist's daddy or Stephen J. Hemsley picking our pockets. And we've allowed that to happen because Reagan changed the rules.
Well, I mean, it's not only Reagan. I mean,
It is the era of Reaganomics. We've been in a Reaganomics era for 32 years. This so-called deregulation, small government, which means large corporations. Government gets smaller, corporations get larger. Government power diminishes, corporate power increases. And right now we're to the point where the government's gone and the corporations have got us by the short hairs, Wayne.
Well, I don't believe in a large government. I don't believe that a government.
Then you do believe in large corporations, because you're going to have one or the other.
Well, I would rather have it's got to be some way that we can have a medium here.
Well, we used to have that under the Eisenhower administration.
I don't want the government telling me what I've got to do for other people.
We had that medium under the Eisenhower administration, and under the Kennedy administration, and under the Johnson administration, and under the Nixon administration, and under the Ford administration, and under the Carter administration. We had a happy medium where basically the big corporations were kept somewhat in control. They couldn't engage in predatory practices. They couldn't engage in monopolistic behavior. Back before Ronald Reagan became president, and I'm guessing you're old enough to remember this, and you know I'm telling you the truth, that back before Ronald Reagan became president, you went into any town in America, and you could tell where you were, because you could look around and see all kinds of locally owned businesses. The little strip malls were all locally owned businesses. People, the entrepreneurs lived side by side with people who worked in their same businesses or factories or shops. The bank, the guy who ran the bank, the president of the bank, lived in the same neighborhood as the people who worked in the tool and die shop, because, you know, there weren't these huge disparities in income and wealth, and every mall was different. And today, after 32 years of Reaganomics, where he said, we're going to make the government smaller, and so the big corporations can get a lot bigger, because you're going to have one or the other. You know, nature abhors a vacuum. Something's going to fill that space.
Well, here's what I'm trying to do.
And now you can walk into any mall or any downtown in America, and you see the same Applebee's and the same Starbucks and the same McDonald's, and you don't see small business America anymore. It is gone.
Well, I understand it. And I'm
That's Reaganomics.
I work in the oil field. I do. I work out here in the oil field. I depend on it for my living.
Yeah.
I work very hard. And I'm a small rancher and farmer, you know.
You're an endangered species, Wayne. The big companies are coming to get you. If you're working in the oil industry, odds are you're probably already working for one of the big monopolies. But, you know, if you're a small rancher or farmer, they want you.
Well, here's my thing. I mean, I work, like I said a while ago, I work very, very hard. There's no reason that people in this United States, as great a country as we are, cannot go and find a job and get off of the government ticket. There's no reason. There is jobs out here.
There are places in this country where there are, well, I can tell you, right here in Washington, D.C., we needed to hire somebody for our TV show a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago, actually, now. We needed to hire a writer. We put an ad in the local paper, and Louise probably got 200 responses. There are, you know, for every job out there, there are dozens and dozens of people looking for work. And now maybe you've got, you know, good times in the oil fields of Newcastle, Oklahoma, Wayne, but that is not the case in much of the United States. And what do you want to just tell those people to go screw themselves? You want to just tell them, hey, tough luck, Charlie?
I'm tired of paying for people that aren't willing to accept responsibility and go out and get a job. It might not be the job you want. It might be a job roofing a house. It might be a job.
There's nobody roofing houses
in a yard.
Wayne, you don't get it. There is jobs out there.
Why don't you go get one?
You don't get it. There are large. You know, when was
yes, sir. I do get it. I live out here in the real world. I see it every day. I see people saying, "Well, I can't find a job. I can't do this and I can't do that." Well, yeah. You know, the word can't...
You might see a few of those people on Fox News. There's always going to be a small percentage of people who are going to abuse the system, Wayne. Typically, it's around 1% or 2% of the people in a society, and you see this in any of the social welfare states, whether it's Sweden or whether it's the United States, who are going to just, you know, live on the dole. And that's going to cost you and me probably $10, $20, $30, maybe $50 or $100 a year out of our taxes for the freeloaders. And I would say that those people probably have mental problems that are undiagnosed because they don't want to work. But the vast majority of Americans want a job. And the simple proof of that is that when the economy is doing well, unemployment drops to 3%.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
As it did during the Clinton administration. As it did before Reaganomics. When the economy is doing well, unemployment drops. People would prefer to work. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Elizabeth in Summertown, Tennessee. Hey, Elizabeth.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Great. We were talking about the Tennessee lottery. Beat the Reaper.
Well, you know, the North Korean thing. Why are all our leaders in so many countries seem so insane? But what I really called was to discuss the insanity of the Tennessee situation. You know, they had the lottery call.
Mm-hmm.
And
was that yesterday or the day before?
I think it was the day before.
Okay.
And there was a glitch in the dialing so that people were told that it was too late, that it had already filled up when it hadn't.
Whoa.
And so there were several hundred people who might have qualified who didn't get to, and I haven't heard, you know, if they've figured that out, how to fix that or not, but they're certainly not going to let more than 2,500 people be beating the Reaper.
Yeah. Yeah, so they might open the window again for the first 200 call. You can be one of the first 200 people to beat the Reaper.
Oh, yeah. No. The whole thing just makes me ill.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to stay healthy, even though I have Medicare now. But,
yeah. Oh, good on that.
I just can't believe that Haslam's not going to take this money. I mean, it's just, you know, that's a death sentence to so many people.
Well, you live in Tennessee. Get all your friends to call his office and let him know that you feel that way. And Elizabeth, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Summertown. Say hi to everybody at the farm for me. Thank you very much. Ann in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Ann, what's up?
Hi. I have a bulletin that I'd like to share with everybody that lives in Chicago. Next Tuesday, April 2nd, is going to be a rally at the Federal Plaza at Adams in Dearborn at noon.
Mm-hmm.
And this will be, it's going to be called Scrap the Cap, and it's keeping Social Security strong.
Great.
And a lot of people will be there from CHA housing. Mm-hmm. Etc. And I also wanted to mention that George Bush made it to the week, and it says that it was a hacker that released a treasure trove of information stolen from the former president's emails.
Mm-hmm.
Among those was the self portraits.
Right.
And a couple of columnists also made the thing of the recurrence of bathing in these pictures as he was trying, like Lady Macbeth, to wash the blood of Iraq from his hands.
Oh, that's interesting. So I see. I haven't seen that anywhere, and I was wondering why. It's good to hear, Anne, that other people have drawn that connection and published it, because you know,
this was the week of February 22nd.
Okay, good. Thank you, Anne, for that. I tell you, we have the smartest and most well-informed viewers and listeners, and thanks for listening to WCPT on Earth. It's great. Nancy in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Nancy, you wanted to...
Hi, Tom. So good to be able to speak with you. I was listening to Wayne from Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
And I hope he'll forgive me for putting it out this way, but it just sounded like he was whining. Yeah, maybe there are jobs in Oklahoma, but they aren't there everywhere. And it just sounded like Wayne's thought that people grew up aspiring to be poor and live off the government. And I feel very sad for him because I don't think he's learned that we need to all be compassionate. I went to college. I'm poor. I'm struggling. I'm on food stamps. I don't get the medical care that I need. I'm disabled, and I work with disabled and special needs students. Mm-hmm. They teach me way more than I could ever hope to begin to teach them. He's complaining because he gets to work in the oil fields, and if I understand correctly, it's fair money.
Yeah.
Last year, the whole year, teaching children who have, people think have no prospects in life, who are never going to succeed. And I think they do. They deserve people who think they do. I earned a whole $3,700. A whole $3,700. I love my students. They are important to me. I work hard every day. And I just don't understand how people can be so callous toward each other and not be caring and understanding and think, wow, but for the grace of the world, that could be me.
Yeah.
We seem to be having a real moral crisis here.
I think so.
I so would like to see that change. It makes me very sad that people don't understand. They don't have the full story, nor do I think they want to hear it.
Yep, I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call, Nancy, and for your comments and for your work. Larry in Columbus, Ohio, you're tired of everyone blaming Bush? Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the biggest hypocrisy I've ever seen. Everybody at that time, and you know this to be true, including David Rockefeller, Hillary Clinton, Kerry, the president of France or whatever they have there, all said the same thing, that they thought there were weapons of mass destruction there, and they all wanted...
No, everybody wasn't saying that. Hans Blix was saying there aren't. You had Scott Ritter saying, I was there, I searched the country, there's nothing there. You had a variety of intelligence services.
Just tell me anything that I just said was wrong.
It's wrong.
Did Hillary Clinton say, did David Rockefeller say there was weapons of mass destruction there?
Ultimately, they said they... Ultimately, yes, they voted to go with Bush. They believed his lies. But when you've got an entire administration cherry-picking intelligence and lying to the people, I don't think that you can be blaming the people who got lied to.
Everybody, including the person that ran the CIA, was Clinton's CIA man. They all heard the same intelligence.
George Tenet, this intelligence was being cherry-picked at the direction of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And I strongly encourage you, Larry, if you really believe this to be the case, to read the book by Michael Isikoff and David Korn called Hubris. It's probably the best blow-by-blow analysis of what happened. And this is not some, you know, left-wing takedown book. I could point you to those, too. But it lays out how we got lied into this war. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, hello, Sue in the chat room. A lot of great folks in the chat room. As is usually the case. It is free. It is fun. It's at TomHartman.com. Check it out. So, anyhow, we've been talking about a lot of things here. One of the big cases before the Supreme Court, basically equality for gay people. I don't know how you can put it beyond that, you know. I can get married. I'm a straight guy. I can get married. You know, why can't a gay person, you know, man or woman or whatever, get married? Doesn't make any sense. So the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, Why Promoting LGBT Equality is Good for Our Health, it laid out three arguments. I thought this was pretty solid stuff. Number one, the children of LGBT parents would grow up healthier. This is according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. They formally endorsed marriage equality. It's interesting. Anthony Kennedy today had something to say about this. Do you have that clip, Shano? Yeah, why don't you play that? This is Anthony Kennedy. One of the,
on the other hand, there is an immediate legal injury or legal, what could be a legal injury, and that's the voice of these children. There are some 40,000 children in California, according to the Red Brief, that live with same-sex parents. And they want their parents to have full recognition and full status.
Yeah. It's interesting to see how the court is going on this. That sounds to me like somebody who gets it. I wonder also, you know, whether, you know, there's this speculation about whether or not Elena Kagan is gay and or lesbian. And whether she is or not, the speculation certainly has to have put this issue in front of the members of the Supreme Court, at least in their own little personal minds. I think that's an interesting one. Here is Sonia Sotomayor. I'm just going to share some clips with you from the chain collected here. He was in the Supreme Court this morning. He heard the arguments. Here's Sonia Sotomayor talking about the rational basis for discrimination other than marriage. Here it is.
Outside of the marriage context, can you think of any other rational basis, reason, for a state using sexual orientation as a factor in denying homosexuals benefits or imposing burdens on them? Is there any other rational decision-making that the government could make? Denying them a job, not granting them benefits of some sort, any other decision?
Your Honor, I cannot. I do not have anything to offer you.
This was the Chuck Cooper, you know, the guy that, say that again? Charles J. Cooper, yeah. Who, you know, the lawyer nobody ever heard of, who is arguing the anti-gay rights side of this before the Supreme Court. And, you know, you could just see the wheels turning. Sotomayor, you know, okay, if you're not going to discriminate against them in anything other than marriage, then why discriminate against them in marriage? Don't get it. Here's Antonin Scalia and a little bit of this dialogue. He clip number three, he opens this thing up. When did gay marriage become unconstitutional in the first place, if I understand that correctly? When did blocking gay marriage become unconstitutional? Here you go.
I'm curious, when did it become unconstitutional to exclude homosexual couples from marriage? 1791, 1868, when the 14th Amendment was adopted. Sometime after Baker, where we said it didn't even raise a substantial federal question. When did the law become this?
I may answer this in the form of a rhetorical question. When did it become unconstitutional to prohibit interracial marriages? When did it become unconstitutional to assign children to
separate... Easy question, schools? I think, for that one. At the time the Equal Protection Clause was adopted. That's absolutely true. But... don't give me a question to my question.
This is Scalia, and that was Ted Olson, right? So Scalia is saying, basically, when did gays get these rights? And Olson is saying, they got them when the 14th Amendment was passed. It's just that we haven't recognized them yet. Just like African Americans got these rights when the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, and then you had to go through the whole Plessy versus Ferguson in 1898, and then Brown v. Board in 1954 to reverse Plessy, and then, you know, all the other, you know, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and it's still going on. You know, we still haven't we, white society, white American society, corporate America, white America, whatever you want to call it, still has not given African Americans full rights in this country. It is still legal, particularly in Republican states, to discriminate against people based on their skin color, particularly when it comes to voting. You can say, oh, yeah, you know, the largest percentage of people in the United States without a photo ID are black people, so let's pass a law that says you got to have a photo ID to vote. And one of those just went into place yesterday in Virginia, as I recall. It was signed into law by Bob McDonald, the governor. So anyhow, Scalia says, when did it become unconstitutional? When did the Constitution require us to acknowledge the rights of gay people? And Ted Olson says, at the same time that it required us to acknowledge the rights of African Americans. And here is Scalia and Olson kind of arguing about this.
As a culture, determined that sexual orientation is a characteristic of individuals that they cannot control.
I see. When did that happen? When did that
happen? There's no specific date in time. This is an
evidence. Well, how am I supposed to know how to decide a case?
Because the case
you can't give me a date when the Constitution changes.
Before you today.
Yeah, but you want a date? How about, let's see, March 26th, 2013. Here's your date. You get to be the date, Mr. Scalia. Here is Theodore Olson, again, Republican, conservative, the guy who argued Bush v. Gore successfully before the Supreme Court and got the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision to hand the presidency of the United States over to George W. Bush in 2000. Here's Theodore Olson arguing on behalf of the rights of gay people to marry, quoting Justice Ginsburg.
I guess the language that Justice Ginsburg used at the closing of the VMI case is an important thing. It resonates with me. A prime part of the history of our Constitution is the story of the extension of constitutional rights to people once ignored or excluded.
Thank you, counsel.
And that is the history of the United States. And that goes back to the point that, and it's very interesting that that's, you know, Olson quoting Ginsburg in rebuttal to, was that in the context of Scalia's question, Shane? This is his closing. Oh, this is his closing. But basically, it's a response to Scalia's question of, you know, when did this right to marry appear in the Constitution? Well, in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, and the 14th Amendment says that no person shall be denied equal protection under the law, that we all are entitled to equal protection under the law. White, black, gay, straight, old, young, male, female, we're all... You could argue 1868 was when women should have gotten those rights, too, except for the fact that the 14th Amendment contains the word male. It's either man or male. And, in fact, it's the reason why Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton opposed the 14th Amendment, because Elizabeth Cady Stanton said, if you get the word male into the Constitution, it'll take 100 years to get it out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And by the way, she was right. It took 100 years to get it out. You know, so we'll be back 15 minutes past. Hey, Howard Dean has launched a new campaign to flip state legislatures. Good on Howard Dean. We got to get him on this program and find out what's going on, get the details of this, find out how we can get people over to help him out and what he's doing, because... You know, Howard Dean was the guy who pushed the 50-state strategy, and he's a good man. Louise and I lived in Vermont when he was the governor. Deidre in Congress, Arizona. Hey, Deidre, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I have a few things to go over, but I have to hurry. My phone is losing its boost on here, my batteries. On the fracking, about a year and a half ago, my husband and I got a list of the things that were in the fracking, and I don't have it in front of me, but... There are 596 hazardous materials,
whoa,
chemicals, that Cheney decided to get rid of them that way, by putting them into fracking.
Yeah, I have long suggested, ever since Dick Cheney carved out, by executive order essentially, an exemption from the Clean Water Act for fracking, that this was the new way that the oil industry was going to get rid of their toxic waste.
Yes.
At no cost.
And so that's what they're doing. And most of them, what we saw, all of them we checked. So far we had about five or six.
Yeah.
They were all carcinogenic.
Of course.
Carcinogenic.
Yeah.
So they're not good.
Yep.
Another thing about the Medicaid.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it has to do with Walmart going to hire 100,000 vets. They mentioned that a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that because Walmart uses our Medicaid in every state to pay to get, you know, food stamps. And I think that's a lot of that what it's doing in these states.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think people like Rick Scott, who has his own clinics, is going to be using our federal dollars.
Sure.
To fund his clinic and make himself more money.
Yeah. That's the interesting thing about Walmart. You wonder if they want to hire the veterans because the veterans come with benefits that
that
Walmart won't get blamed for. I mean, right now, when Walmart's presence expands in a state, so does the number of people on food stamps and on Medicaid, because basically most of the people working for them are poor enough to qualify for those things, and this is how we subsidize Walmart. If they hire vets who already have Veterans Administration benefits and maybe even a veterans pension, they may not qualify for Medicare, Medicaid, and food stamps, and Walmart's statistics will start looking better. I'm just speculating.
They're not getting their things right now. It's taking so long.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other problem. A very serious problem, one that Bernie Sanders.
Well, that's happened since World War One. They didn't get theirs till what, the '50s.
Yeah, well, look at that was the bonus army. Actually, I think FDR sped that up in 1933 or 1934. He started paying them off, but. That was
and
the occupation
World
of the
War II. It's the same thing.
Yeah,
they didn't get theirs for a long time.
Yeah,
Vietnam.
That was the occupation. Well, there's Vietnam veterans who are just now starting to get their benefits. Deidre, I got a whole bunch of people on hold. I want to move along. Thank you so much for calling. Thanks for watching us there in Arizona. Jim in Stockport, Ohio. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Tom, first of all, I cannot tell you how good I think both your TV and radio shows are. And keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, sir.
And, I just came across some new research. Wondered if you ever heard about it, if you'd have a comment on it. In the current issue of the Ohio State University Alumni Magazine, of which I'm a proud alumni, every issue has several articles on, you know, the latest cutting-edge research being done in all kind of fields at Ohio State.
Mm-hmm.
And the one was on happiness, and it's supposed to be the first of its kind to try to measure all the factors that affect your life and what affects your happiness and what do people need to be happy.
Right.
And it was everything from your income, your job, if you liked your job, hated it, if you were married, if it was a good marriage, bad marriage, where you live, if you live where you want to or you're stuck somewhere to get a job, and your safety, health care, all that. And the one thing that really surprised them in the results was income. And as your income went up, your happiness went up to $75,000 in income.
And then it flattens out.
And after $75,000, it didn't make, whether you made $2,000 or $200 million more, it didn't make a whit's difference.
Yep. Yep.
And what they said was that it was the first study of its kind. They want to refine it, expand the sample, and they think it's not the be-all and end-all, but it might lead to some real valid research.
Yeah. But, and I would guess, Jim, that $75,000 in today's dollars was probably about what my dad was making when he was working in a tool-and-die shop, and he had full benefits, and he had a pension. And
listen, I'm born in 1950. I'm a boomer, too, and you talk about your little bit that you read about your personal life. Me and you are, very similar, let's put it that way. But here's the deal. One thing struck me while I was on hold for 45 minutes listening to your show, you made the comment, these people, condemning the welfare cheats, and you said it's about 1% or 2%.
Yeah.
And even in a good economy, these are the people that would stay on welfare, try to get it, refusing to work when they can get jobs, 1-2%. And then what really struck me was you said, and your guess is that they might have some kind of a mental illness.
Right.
Well, if $75,000 and above that doesn't add to your happiness, and God knows, I mean, make the money and do what you want with it. But so you have $200 million. Your next million ain't going to make you happier. Besides being greedy and selfish, would they have some kind of a mental
Illness? Yeah. I have asserted on this program numerous times that people who are incredibly wealthy, who obsess on their money and spend all their time trying to get even wealthier and in the process destroy other people's lives. People like Mitt Romney, who had that factory, it wasn't Solyndra, it's something that sounds like that, in the Midwest, that they literally were, Sensata, that's right, Sensata. They dismantled this factory brick by brick and shipped it off to China just before the election, just so the Bain Capital could make more money. People like that are mentally ill. I believe that they have a form of obsessive compulsive disorder, and the object of their obsession and their compulsion is money. And, for some people it's washing hands. For some people it's hoarding. Their entire house is filled with newspapers all the way up to the ceiling. And for people like Mitt Romney, it's money, and I think it is a mental illness, and I agree with you. And I've seen a lot of studies that back up your suggestion that that $75,000 threshold is there. And you, Jim, I'm going to put you on hold. You are winning a copy of Rewinning the American Dream. Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Jim is on line 8, Danielle, and he gets a copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, by me, autographed by me, sent to him by Stamps.com. The good, the bad, and the very, very estively ugly. The good. Senator Bernie Sanders and the Democratic senators. The Vermont senator took a stand for the New Deal Friday night. Teaming up with his Democratic colleague, Senator Sanders attached an amendment to the Senate budget bill opposing any attempt to change the way Social Security benefits are calculated. In recent weeks, the White House has floated the idea of changing the way Social Security cost of living increases are calculated, something called the chained CPI, a decision that would drastically reduce benefits for millions of seniors. Using the chained CPI to determine benefits is unnecessary and unfair to all the working Americans who have paid into their retirement funds over the past few decades. Although there's no guarantee that the amendment will pass final budget negotiations, it is reassuring to see Democrats are willing to fight for their base, even if the president is not. The bad. Albany, New York Police Department. The city's SWAT team raided a low-income, mostly black community as part of a mock fire training exercise last week. According to the chief of police, Stephen Krakow, the department wanted to use a realistic setting to prepare its officers for military-style action. Nice to know that Albany's public servants see entire neighborhoods as combat zones. Aren't the police supposed to protect communities, not terrify them? Although Chief Krakow has since acknowledged his department's mistake, this incident should be a reminder to everyone that many police departments see all African Americans as criminals, even if they've never committed a single crime, and that is just shameful. And the very, very ugly Robert Zimmerman Jr. For many Americans, George Zimmerman, the man who shot and killed Trayvon Martin last February, is a symbol of America's deep-rooted racism. Meet Robert, George's brother. In a series of tweets this weekend, the younger Zimmerman compared Trayvon Martin to a teenager who shot and killed a baby in Atlanta last week. He also slammed the, quote, liberal media for not seeing the obvious connection between Martin and the Atlanta shooter. The obvious connection between these two shooters, their race. Unbelievable. The level of bigotry needed to even think of, let alone make such a comparison, is just very, very. That's mind-blowing. That's incredible. Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. Hey, Danette, you're on the air. What's up?
Hi. Hi, Tom. Your show has just been really wonderful to listen to today. You have talked about a lot of topics. The topic that I was calling about was that of same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. And I got in on the beginning of your show where you had the gentleman where you asked him the question, he was your guest, and you'd asked him the question of whether or not same-sex marriage, you wanted him to demonstrate how it had affected, quote-unquote, traditional marriage.
Right.
And he never answered the question. And to me, it's mind-blowing how people will use that argument, even the fact that marriage is supposed to be about procreation. It's not. I mean, having children is part of it, but it's not the reason. It used to be 50 years ago or maybe 100 years ago that that might have been the reason. But now you've got people that are choosing not to marry, and you've got people that choose to marry, and then you've got people that are married who beat their wives, and they have, you know, extramarital affairs, and they assault their children. You know, it's like nobody is perfect. And for the right, and Christians in particular, and this for me as a Christian is extremely embarrassing, is that we want to go around and tell people how to live when we've got issues within our own homes that we're not willing to deal with. And I've never seen a gay man or a lesbian woman walk in my house and create an argument between me and my husband, ever. So I just don't understand how same-sex marriage has anything to do with that man and his relationships, or with anybody else in their relationships. And it was the Supreme Court case of Loving versus Virginia,
right,
that actually set the standard for whether or not you could dictate that. I mean, like you said before, people thought that, you know, the moon was going to turn to blood, and locusts were coming when interracial marriage was legalized. It doesn't matter. People need to mind their business, fix their own marriages, and stop trying to dictate to other people through the quote unquote morality or through religion, which I think is unconstitutional. They shouldn't be doing that. And
well,
I don't understand it.
Here's two things to consider. The first is that Clarence Thomas, who is an African-American married to a white woman, his marriage mm-hmm. did not fall into the definition of traditional marriage until about 30 years ago. It was illegal in many states in the United States. And it took mm-hmm. the Supreme Court finally to strike that down. And so I would hope that he would be sensitive to, you know, this so-called definition of traditional marriage. We'll see. We'll find out tomorrow. Well, we'll find out in a few months, but, you know, the arguments.
Yeah, I don't. I personally, Clarence Thomas gives me a lot of pause because he's not set such a good standard. And anybody who wants to stand on a high horse and talk about, oh, well, it's going to cause problems. Let's talk about the fact that it's okay for women to be assaulted, and it's the woman's fault. Men don't have to be responsible for anything in that situation. Then they can father children and not be responsible for them, or leave women. And not that all children are born out of rape. I'm just saying that our society has woes. You know, women
sure.
are victims. Children are left without parents, you know, whether it's that the mother can't handle having the child, and then the child is left to be with the state. And let it be an African-American child. My brother, we adopted my brother when he was 4. Mm-hmm. He was labeled at 4 years old as unadoptable. That is disgusting.
Yeah.
And so if there are people out there that want to have children, whether it's through the means of artificial insemination, or whether it's through a surrogate, or whether it's through the adoption, the process of adoption, children need homes.
Yeah,
and
I
don't think it really matters. I do know that it does take two people to run a home, because you've got to have a team. You know, you
mm-hmm.
can't, my husband is retired military. And after 24 years of service, he's now a truck driver. And there are nights where I just wish that he was home so that I could wash the dishes and he could give the kids a bath. Something
yeah.
suffers when you've got a household to run, and it does take two people, but it doesn't mean that it has to be a man and a woman.
Yeah. Jeanette, I agree. If I can make two quick points. Number one, safety and security. I absolutely agree with you that this is a basic human need. Abraham Maslow identified it back in the 1970s with this hierarchy of human needs, and that part of safety and security for a child is the economic safety and security that is associated with having both of their parents being legally married, because then they have access to a whole variety of benefits and remedies at law and you know, whatnot, that would not be available for that child, gay or straight. And so, you know, there is some advantage to society because we've constructed it. We've constructed this legal construct of people being married, straight or gay. But secondly, you asked the question earlier on and in this conversation, and maybe rhetorically, but I actually have an answer to it, of whose marriage, what straight couple's marriage is going to be threatened by gays getting married? And I think that there is an answer to that question. And I think that the answer to that question reveals to you who these people are who are like running the Family Research Council and running all these other right-wing organizations where they're out there in the media constantly saying, oh, we can't have gays marry because if gays marry, it's going to threaten the institution of marriage. And I would submit to you that these are people who are like Larry Craig. They are people who are themselves gay, who never seriously confronted that, or who denied it, or who stuffed it so deep down inside that it has scrambled them up, and they got married, and they can't figure out quite why their marriage doesn't work exactly the way it's supposed to, and occasionally they may even pop up in a men's room like Larry Craig did. And if gay marriage was accepted, widely accepted, then those people could project a future where they might leave the woman that they're uncomfortable with and join into a marriage union with that guy down the street that they think is such a hunk. And because we tend to assume everybody else thinks the way we do, I'm guessing that, you know, a number of these Larry Craig type guys are at least the ones who don't have, you know, who aren't the brightest bulbs on the tree, may think that there's a lot of closeted gay men out there who are, you know, and they want to keep them in the same kind of relationship. Am I making sense here?
You are making sense. And the sad part is that they use religion.
Yes.
And people who, whether it's right or wrong,
yeah,
they believe. Now, I did say that I'm a Christian, and I believe in that as a Christian, our faith gives us grace, and that there are certain aspects of the Old Testament that don't apply to the society and the
like
day
don't
that
eat shellfish.
Now.
No, I'm with you, Danette. But the question that I'm asking myself constantly is, who are these men, or in a few cases women, who sit around all day worried about gay people? I mean, I don't sit around thinking about gay people all day.
I don't either. And I have to
believe that they're closeted gays.
They probably are, and they use religion to rile up people who believe every nook and cranny of the Bible that is convenient for them, and they don't necessarily practice all of it, but they only want to pick and choose what they want to.
I think they are people who have become the victims of their own bigotry, and thus, you know, it's kind of like Freudian transference or projection, or a bit of both, actually. Thus, they're projecting their own bigotry on others, or inflicting it on others. Danette, thank you for the call. Thanks for the thoughtful call. Thanks for listening to us in Hinesville and Sirius.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. By the way, check out free-don.org. Don Siegel, America's current political prisoner. Free-don.org. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. That was a fascinating call. That was fascinating. Chris in Miami, Florida. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Very good, thank you. And you?
I'm a big fan of your show, and actually I wanted to call and ask you a question because I think you could help me out with this.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is talking about gay marriage, and one of the things that I wonder about is you have a small group of people who are very afraid of it going through. And I happen to believe that it will go through. I think at some point in time, it's just going to be a normal thing.
Yes.
But what I wonder about is it possible that this can infringe upon the freedom of religion? And what I mean specifically is, let's say, you know, Catholic churches or mosque or, you know, any religious group which doesn't subscribe to gay marriage, what happens to them if they refuse to basically make that a part of their religion?
Well, to this day, if you are Catholic and you want to marry somebody who's not Catholic, a priest has the right and usually exercises it to say, sorry, you can't get married in this church. To this day, if you are two Catholics who are married and you want to get a divorce, the Catholic Church will officially say, sorry, we're not going to recognize that divorce. If you're Jewish and you know, one of the more conservative congregations, and even I think maybe in many Reform congregations, although I'm not Jewish, I don't know. But I know that, you know, typically, well, we have a very good friend who converted from Catholicism to Judaism so that she could marry her husband and so that her children would be Jewish. And so, you know, none of that has been blown up, you know, by the fact that people who are Catholics and Jews can legally marry under the eyes of the law. They still can't legally marry in the eyes of their respective churches. So, you know, a church can say, no, I'm not going to marry this couple because they're not the same religion. They can say that they don't want to marry this couple because they're gay, not straight, I would think. I don't know that anybody has suggested that churches would be forced to perform gay marriages, particularly given all the things that churches can say, no, I don't want to marry people over as it is. Make sense?
So basically then, this small group of people who are very afraid of it, in a way, it's not really infringing upon their right to express their religion or believe what they want.
Divorce laws. I mean, I'm not old enough to remember when divorce was legalized in the United States. I mean, it might have happened when I was a little kid, but it would probably happen state by state. I don't know that much about the history of divorce in the United States. But I do know that in the late 70s, early 80s, Louise and I were, I think Louise was with me, we were traveling through Ireland, and there were these billboards about every 15, 20 miles out in the countryside that showed a mother and a father and a little child, a little girl standing between them, and she had tears coming down her eyes. And, you know, mom and dad nobody was touching anybody. It was just the three of them and this little girl with these tears visibly coming down her eyes. And the giant headline said something like "Vote No on Proposition Q" or whatever it was. And I kept wondering, you know, what is this proposition or ballot measure or whatever it was referred to in Ireland? What is this? And after seeing these signs for a couple of days, Louise and I were sitting in a bar, and as I recall, in Dublin, talking to a couple of locals, and I said, "Hey, what's this Proposition Q thing?" And they said, "Oh, we're going to have a nationwide referendum on whether to legalize divorce." Now, up to that point, divorce was illegal in Ireland. And the argument that was made by the church was, if you legalize divorce, it's going to destroy the institution of marriage. Now, frankly, I think that you can make a much stronger argument for that than you can make that, you know, gays getting married is going to destroy the institution of marriage. I think gays getting married is going to expand the number of people who will get married. And if anything, it's probably going to strengthen the institution of marriage, at least from the point of view of the people who run the marriage cathedrals and the, you know, sell the flowers for the weddings and things.
Right.
But divorce being decriminalized in Ireland did not cause people to stop getting married. And I don't know what it did to the divorce rate. Obviously, the divorce rate went up because it was illegal before that. But it did pass, by the way.
I happen to think that that's probably why you have a lot of people who get really riled up on this. They really feel that if gay marriage goes through, that somehow their religion is going to be affected by it.
I don't think so. I really don't. Chris, you know, thank you for the call. I want to move along to others, but I do want to make just this one point. I would ask any of my viewers or listeners who feel threatened by gays getting married and who think about gays a lot and who are very concerned about gays and who think about gay subculture and gay bars and spend a lot of time imagining what gay people might be doing and worrying about it, to seek some professional help. I don't mean that as a joke, and I don't mean that facetiously, because there's something going, there's some inner turmoil there that needs to be addressed. Mary in Cornwall, New York. We have a little less than a minute, Mary, before we have to wrap up the show. It's all yours.
Hi, Tom. Good afternoon. I was listening to the beginning part of your show when you spoke about George Bush washing his feet in the paintings that he has made,
mm-hmm.
and you were talking about washing the blood off of his hands.
Yeah.
But it struck me, especially in this time that we're in right now, that the Christians believe in Easter, that it was like Pontius Pilate wiping and washing the blood off of his
hands. And Passover, you know, with the putting the blood over the door stoops to say to God, don't kill the people in this house. That's a good point. This is a time that is kind of drenched in blood, religiously speaking. Thank you for the call. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest on the Supreme Court as they review DOMA. Yes, Shano is going to be in the Supreme Court again tomorrow, and he'll come back and he'll tell you and me all about it tomorrow afternoon. Plus, Congressman Mark Pocan is going to be with us about the hearings. He's an openly gay member of the U.S. House of Representatives. And why is the DOJ, the Department of Justice, throwing the book at Aaron Schwartz's while the banksters go free? We're going to talk to Matt Taibbi about it. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.